Hello.
Hi, Paul.
Hello, Craig. Hi. Right, it's the 16th of November, 2014. Tonight's audio cast is with Craig Yelland. Craig is a new interviewee. He's a full-time investor. And do you want to briefly tell us about your background, Craig?
Yeah, no worries. I've been a full-time investor now for a couple of years. Prior to that, I worked in the city as a commodities trader, which obviously might make a few people a bit wary of me, but it wasn't quite as it's portrayed on films like Trading Places. I was very much involved in managing risk managing positions and mitigating risk for our exposures. It's very much about looking after the downside and just trying to pocket small wins more often rather than looking for big punts. And that's something I look to try and take into my portfolio now as an investor.
Yeah, so what is your investing style now that you're a full-time investor, Craig?
Well, now I'm a full-time investor. Obviously, I have to try and earn an income and a living out of my portfolio. So I do run quite a diversified portfolio with a mix between a lot of small-cap plays where I'm active and then a fairly high amount of yielding stuff. And that could be high-yielding equities or a decent portion of fixed income exposure as well, such as bank preference shares and that sort of thing, which are obviously worth quite good value a couple of years ago and now just providing a good perpetual income. I'm also not averse to letting someone else do the heavy lifting and outsource some of my portfolio to fund managers to look after as well. Although it's full-time investing, I don't like to be 60 hours a week on it. I like to get out and play around the golf and that sort of thing. So my main focus when it comes to being more active is in the small cap area, because obviously that's where you can make the outsized returns. I'm not looking to be super greedy. If I can sort of target a long term return of 10 to 12% a year, that's gonna do me fine. At 12%, you're doubling your portfolio every 6 years. So
that's a very good point, actually. Power of compounding.
Exactly. Yeah. Without being I'm not really looking to. Well, it'd be nice to do 100% every year, but obviously that's far from achievable. I know you managed it very early on from listening to you at Derby the other week, but obviously not everyone can. So I tend to be quite conservative, quite a fairly large number of positions, but I try to keep the ones that I'm focused on down to a maximum of sort of 20-25 stocks, and the other ones will be collectives or stocks where you can sort of stick them in the bottom drawer and just let them look after themselves.
Okay. Thanks for that. Looking at last week, I know we thought we'd home in on five particular stocks that reported from last week they're all five are turnaround situations, really, aren't they? Or potential turnarounds. First one is my biggest holding, Indio Vision. Now, they put out a profits warning, basically, last Tuesday this week, just gone, which came completely out of the blue and followed some, prior to that, very encouraging trading updates. So I wrote about it fairly in detail on my blog, just saying that, unfortunately, it's an inherently unpredictable business, and they just had a bad quarter. It happens from time to time, very disappointing. But what's your take on it, Craig?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I was a little bit annoyed with the warning, more so out of the fact that the CEO had been putting out some very bullish statements in the months before, and it did seem to come as a bit of a bolt out of the blue. And my fear with this company is that it is unpredictable in nature, but they seem to be more unpredictable on the downside in the last few years than on the upside, which is a little bit disappointing. I must admit, I did have a holding and I did sell on the profit warning. It's not a rule I stick hard and fast to, but I do. Whenever there's a profit warning, I do tend to hit the sell button pretty quickly. On the basis, not necessarily other than the fact that as a PI, your advantage is that you can react a bit quicker than the larger holders. And if you get out immediately, but you write a story, you can always even get back in later that day or over the next couple of weeks at a lower price than you sold. But you might miss out.
I take your point on that, but although with Indigo in particular, if you look back at the chart, there are quite a few times where it has warned on profits, and actually, if you'd waited 2 or 3 months, that would have, it then would have been, a, you know, it's often actually a very good time to buy, historically.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly, no, exactly. It's not hard and fast. So on this one I have, it's something I'm still looking to reevaluate. I think then it has sold off, and it has seemed to have stabilised. So it's one of those ones that...
I mean, I was expecting it to have two or three down days, but it didn't. It just had a one down day, down about 16%, and it stayed at that level. So I'm wondering, you know, if I think most of the shareholders in this are long-term. I'm wondering if shareholders just understand and accept the fact that it's a very volatile business because the contracts are high margin, individual contracts are very significant to the overall results, and every now and again they just have a lousy quarter.
Yeah, I mean, that could well be the case. I mean, the thing is as well, this time it's quite it's in a unique phase, isn't it, at the moment, because you're going through the change of the year end at the moment. It means you're having sort of 17, 18 months of business, so it's quite hard to do sort of like for likes and things like you run over an extended period. But I take the point. It's probably one that may come back. It's a little bit like one that I think you touched on a couple of weeks ago, Andrew Sykes, where historically it's a cyclical business and all affected by the weather, but the time to buy is sometimes on the profit warning because you've had the bad piece and the good pieces to come. So
well, that's exactly what I did. I've been waiting years for Andrew Sykes to warn on profits, and when it did, I was absolutely delighted. And I bought sort of 4-9 o'clock that day, and I'm already up about 15% on them. So,
it rebounded pretty much immediately. So it doesn't always happen like that, but there are stocks like that. I find as a rule, it's served me quite well this year. It doesn't always, but sell first and reevaluate. At the very least, have a good introspection on the price anyway.
Yeah, no, I think those are fair comments. Indigo, you've got a good dividend yield as well, and the balance sheet's bulletproof. I tend to be reluctant to sell, and also the valuation's cheap now, 29 million market cap. So personally, I'm sitting tight, but obviously I'm disappointed. I can't say I'm as enthusiastic about the stock as I was 3 or 4 months ago, because obviously it was trading a lot better 3 or 4 months ago. So,
say 3 or 4 months ago, actually, said, if you listen to what the CEO was saying, not in official terms, but in the press and some of the metrics that were being quoted, and you thought, actually, this is a real go-getter. I can see nice doubling of the money over the next 6 months, 6 to 12 months.
But that could still happen. I mean,
it's more likely to happen now than it was at £5 at least. So.
Well, that's right. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm disappointed, but I'm going to stick with it. I've been in the bloody thing for 10 years, so I'm not going to.
You are a long-term holder in that one. So.
So okay, so that's Indigo. Then we had another stock that I think we're both in. So you're not in Indigo anymore, but I am. But then, correct. Are you still in Norcross?
Yes, I am. I've actually added to that over the last 6 weeks. Not for. Because I expect an immediate catalyst, but I do quite like the company. The results weren't particularly awe-inspiring, but they weren't bad at all. Certainly up on all the metrics. Solid, exactly. Yeah. Solid. Not only is going to trigger an immediate re-rating, but steady as she goes.
Yeah, and the ticker on Norcross is NXR. It's a bathroom fittings company. Market cap is 94 million. I went through something I did like is that the company put the presentation slides that they showed analysts and investors. They put them up on their website as well last week for the interims, and I went through those last night. There's about 30 pages of them, and the business looks in good shape actually. They seem to have finished all the restructuring, so nice clean numbers with no funnies in them, whereas they've had restructuring costs year after year over the last 3 or 4 years. The cash flow's great. Dividend's up 9%, I think. So dividend yields.
Nearly
4% dividend yields.
They seem to be making the right sort of move. South Africa seems to be turning around, albeit from a very low base.
It does. I mean, the slide on South Africa showed it looks as if its run rate of profitability is now about 2 million a year, which isn't much, but it was loss-making break-even for a while. The other interesting thing is they've absorbed this huge depreciation of the South African rand without it really having any impact on profits at all.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the rand is. I mean, I haven't looked at it recently, but I'm sure it's about 18 to the pound, which is
is
pretty high from historical. I've been there a few times, and I think whenever I've been there, it's sort of lowest it's been is 10, and the maximum it's been is 12, 13. So. It's obviously quite low levels. I noticed in the results they're a little bit hit by by some business not turning up in the Middle East, both in the tiles and the...
That was Vardo as well, wasn't it? Yeah, that's right.
So that's a concern, but if they put it down to customer destocking, so I mean, that could just be, again, that could be a one-time hit that we'll look to, if that triggers back in. The one thing I did notice in there is they did have a 1.6 million gain on a derivative, which flattered the profits a little bit.
Oh, did it? I didn't spot that. Is that within the normal 1.6? That's quite material, isn't it? 1.6 million.
It is. Yeah. I mean, and it was up. It was a 2.5.
Oh, was that
million
something dropped? Ah, that affected last year's figures, though, not this year's, didn't it?
It's 2.5 million lost this year, and 1.6 up this year. Million last year, and 1.6 up this year.
Oh, I didn't spot that. I'll have a look at the numbers, because I mean, the key thing for me is they confirmed full year guidance, didn't they? And I've got a copy of the House Broker note, which confirmed 1.9p EPS for this year, which is a fully taxed number, which wasn't the case last year. So at 15.5p, it's only on a current year PE of about 7 or 8, so it looks very cheap to me.
I think it does. As I say, it's one of those ones where I think a lot of people put off by pension deficit on that, the pension liabilities, and there was another change to the pension this time. I think it was down 20 million.
It worsened, didn't it? Yeah, the IAS 19 deficit went from 20 million to 40 million, so it doubled. But it's the difference between two huge numbers, isn't it? But the interesting thing is that the presentation slide said that the overpayment schedule that a company has to make is £2 million per annum for 15 years.
Well, exactly, which is...
That's a perfectly manageable amount that doesn't, you know, generates about 20 million EBITDA, 14 million operating profits, so it's not a big deal.
No, it's not. I mean, I think people get scared off sometimes by these numbers being thrown around, but it is, I mean, it's worthwhile noting that discount, that change has come from the discount rate changing from sort of 4.1% to 3.9%, which is just...
Yes.
It's a reflection of the fact that we're likely to have lower interest rates for longer. If that were, it doesn't take much for that in the economy for that to switch around, and suddenly, you see the long term rates going up to 4.5, and suddenly that pension's in a surplus.
The deficit's gone. Yeah, exactly. I agree. And by the way, I should emphasise we're not giving any sort of financial advice here or recommendations. These are just personal opinions only. Sorry, I forgot the disclaimer. I should have said that earlier.
Anyone who listens to it knows it's not worth advice, so that's all right.
That's true. Talking about another turnaround, slide B, they reported, was it interim results on Wednesday, just gone. Any view on that one, Craig?
Yeah, well, the major disclaimer is up front is that I don't tend to... invest in airlines. I'm very much.
I normally don't either.
But in this one, I don't own any shares in this. But in this one, it does seem that they've now got a good management team in there. Lots of experience, been there, sort of done that. I think they were ex-EasyJet, if I recall
That's
correctly.
Right. Yeah.
And they seem to be making the right move. They've exited their Finnish business, which was obviously a bit of a drain around there. Albeit they got out for a nominal £1. If you can get out of a loss-making business, it's pretty nice.
Isn't it?
And they seem to have done a few transactions around their fleet as well. Not 100% sure of. I don't say I'm not an expert in the airline industry by any means, but it seemed that they changed the type of plane they actually wanted to run for.
That's right.
Going forward.
They're using prop planes that can land on shorter runways, aren't they? Rather than jets. And the only thing that really concerned me from the numbers, because the headline figures look bad, but if you drilled into the detail, the underlying UK performance was actually slightly up. But they separate out this fleet surplus fleet line, which is quite a chunky number. I think it was something like 14 million off the top of my head for 6 months costs. Well, that's obviously the big issue that they need to resolve to one way or another get rid of those planes. But for me, I think the numbers weren't quite as good as I was expecting, but the turnaround's on track, and I think this time next year, I think the shares might well be usefully higher. Strong balance sheet as well, I remember, on that one.
Yeah, well, exactly. They got their fundraising away, didn't they, which strengthened the balance sheet nicely. And they're introducing some nice new lines. Going into London City, I think, could be a nice winner for them. I think they said they've got 9 planes left on that they're looking to get rid of or something.
Oh, it's only 9? Right.
But it is still a hefty charge. If they can get rid of them, then that's obviously that off the balance sheet. And this nice growth that's in the UK business
And the Virgin got did their IPO in New York as well last week, didn't they? Which got off to a flying start. Oh, sorry, a lousy pun, a flying start. I think that opened up 27 or 29% or something. And Flybe shares, I noticed, went up 4 or 5% on that day. Low oil price as well, of course, is very, very
I wonder how much that will come through and help them out. It's got to help some. It's got to help the airlines out. So they seem to be, I think I was reading something earlier, they seem to be very slow to pass on a reduction in the fuel surcharge. Petrol stations, I suppose, more than anything.
Yes. Okay. Then we were going to touch on a real minnow that both of us caught both of our eye last week, Red 24, which is some sort of monitoring company or something, isn't it? Tiny little thing, 4 million, 4.9 million market cap. I think,
It seems to be a sort of security risk management and that sort of thing. It seemed interesting. I mean, they announced earlier in the year they had a big contract with HSBC, which seems to be around sort of identity theft. And that hasn't actually, it's not actually reflected in these figures. It's going to hit the second half figures and next year's figures fairly hefty. But they seem to, it's all giving the impression that they're mitigating that. They're winning new contracts. And to a certain extent, some of the other divisions are picking up the slack. I mean, they did very nicely. They did at least break down their four areas. And the one that's really been a go-getter year is their consulting business, which has tripled its turnover, tripled its profits this year. And they've mainly on the basis of a large piece of business they had evacuating some staff of a Far East company out of North Africa. So that's not recurring. But I mean, it seems to me there seems to be more spats and issues occurring worldwide at the moment. So if that's the business you're in, I suspect you're going to get, if you can build up a nice portfolio of previous work, you may well be higher up the call when they happen.
And also, I mean, the other things I liked about this one, I only looked at it very briefly, I must admit, but the balance sheet's got loads of cash on it, and it was it's paying a dividend yield of nearly 5%.
Exactly. Dividend 5%. Half the market cap is now in cash on the balance sheet. So.
Oh, is it that much? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's 2.45
million. It's phenomenal downside protection. So it's one of those ones. If they can turn it around nicely, get some new contracts on board, you could see some very good upside because you're gonna see some a lot of that.
That's right. And the main thorn in the side is this big contract that's dropping off in the second half, isn't it? So it will be interesting to see the full year numbers to see how much they've been impacted by that. But potentially interesting that one.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken a small position. Just I think it's one of those ones that you could see some a nice turnaround story there. Take a position to at least make sure you keep looking at it.
I found with these real micro cap 4 or 5 million things, when something goes wrong, I find you tend to get left high and dry. I mean, similar sort of market cap thing, I bought some stock in a thing called PSL, what was it, PSL Lead or something it was called, and they went from 5p to 10p, so I thought, oh, well, I'll sell them now. So I tried to sell at 10p, and I only managed to sell 10% of my holding, which was literally buttons, you know.
Yes.
There was just no bid in any size. Anyway, they've just drifted down from 10p down to about 3p.
Yeah, lighting company, isn't it? Something like
that's that. Right, yeah, and it's just a serial disappointment. So in the end, I just slung them out and thought, right.
Sometimes you have to. It's possibly a false psychology, but at least if you're taking a loss, you can mitigate against your CGT. It's 28% smaller or 18% smaller.
Yes, good point. Yes.
Sometimes I can justify it to myself by doing that.
I mean, the other thing I think is with these real micro caps, where you've got illiquidity being a real issue, and even in buying amounts of sort of £5,000 to £10,000 worth of stock can create liquidity problems. Some of these things only trade in £1,000 at a time. I think for that reason, I always look for much bigger upside. Personally, I wouldn't buy into anything of that market cap unless there was at least 100% upside potential on the shares, because you downside, you know, if something goes wrong, you're locked in, you can't get out of the damn thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, say you might get a 20% knock on a profit warning, but by the time you've actually exited your holding, you're probably down 50%. So.
Yes, I agree. Okay, and then just one other one that caught my eye last week, I'm not sure if you've looked at this one, the electrical contractors, E. Clark. Ticker is CTO. Now, they put out quite an interesting statement. I should preface this by saying that I've been very scathing about this company in the past on my Stockopedia reports, because it's got a fairly weak balance sheet, not disastrously weak. They sought a waiver of their banking covenants a few months ago, which normally I would just run for the hills when I read that. I'm pretty sure there's a pension deficit. There's loads of things wrong with it. But what caught my eye is they said in this announcement last week that they've won some really big contracts, very impressive contract wins to fit out new office blocks in central London, lots of them. And they're saying the market's tightening, which means, of course, that they're starting to get pricing power back. And this thing's very cyclical. So you could see, potentially, over the next couple of years, the profits on this really start to go up considerably. It is high risk. So, any views on this one, Craig?
Yeah, well, I'm just looking at the historical. It seems to me that the revenues there haven't actually changed materially for 6 years.
True.
But the margin has been eroded from a lot for this type of business down to less than 1%, and that seems to have triggered everything. I mean, if you go back to sort of 2000, I'm just looking at the Stockopedia figures here, but if you go back to sort of 2008, they were making 9 million on 220 million revenues, and now they're on sort of 220 million revenues making 2 million. So if they can get some pricing pressure, that the revenue number seems to be fairly steady. Awesome. So if they can get some pricing power back.
I spoke to one of their advisors last week, who's known the company for years, and he gave me a very good brief on the company. He said they have mostly their own full-time employees who they look after their staff by keeping them on in a recession, and they just take work on at lower margins in order to maintain their skill base. And then to a certain extent, you'd expect them to run slightly above break even in depressed economic times. But they then got all the expertise ready and waiting to go as soon as the market tightens up. Because if you're fitting out all the electricals and which were computer networks and everything like that in some brand new office block in central London, it's not the sort of job you can just bus in a load of Romanians to do. It's very specialized work. T-Clark have a very good reputation, so you know they are becoming scarce. So they're now finding that clients are wanting to book them up to do projects, and they're less bothered about the price. Well, that could potentially be very, very lucrative for them, I think.
Yeah, exactly, and it's a sensible approach, which you don't actually see anymore. Normally, first thing you do is cut staff when it starts getting a bit tough. You lose your expertise, and you start hiring them to overpay fairly heftily when it starts getting up again, so you're not actually any better off in the longer business.
No, that's the point, actually. I mean, I did read in the Evening Standard that I think construction workers were seeing pay rises of sort of around 15% in central London because of shortage of supply. So I asked the company's advisor about that and said, can they manage the wage inflation risk? And he said, yes, it is an issue. They will have to pay staff more, but they've got very long-serving staff. He said a typical T-Clark member of staff has been there 10 or 20 years, is locked in, you know, has the loyalty from having been looked after during the recession and all the rest of it. So I thought that was quite encouraging. Again, do want to emphasize that one is high risk. There's a very high dividend yield on it as well, but I looked at that and I thought the divvy didn't look safe to me. I think they should probably cut the dividend and rebuild their balance
sheet. Yeah, I mean, it seems to be cut that profit, but I know it's got a fairly negative free cash flow at the moment. It's not covered out of cash, but it's out of accounting profits. But you can afford to have a monitor for a while and probably wait for the next update, and you probably won't be too far off price wise to where you are now. But it's definitely one to stick on the watch list, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, another friend mentioned to me that this one has been a serial disappointer in the past. I think he held shares in it years ago, and he said every single year without fail they missed their forecast earnings. So he was very negative on it. But I just think it's an interesting. This might be the right point in the cycle to look at this one. So I thought that one was interesting. Okay, any other companies from last week, Craig, that caught your eye?
Not for results wise, no.
Okay.
There was a couple of announcements from one of my bigger holdings, which was GLI Finance.
Now, that was the next section I was going to go on and ask you about that. So that dovetails in. I normally ask each interviewee about their favourite current position and what they like about them. So do you want to tell us a bit about GLIF?
Yes, it owns a conglomerate of P2B, well, I don't know, it's probably not the right word, but it owns a multiple amount of P2B lending businesses across, not always peer-to-peer, but it can be invoice discounting. I think they've got about 16 or 17 different investments now. They announced two more this week, one in France, one in Africa.
So they're buying crowdfunding businesses, is that what you mean?
Crowdfunding, lending, invoice discounting, obviously it's all the same sort of. I'm quite a big fan of companies that are looking to replace the banks in the business cycle. It's pretty clear that banks are pulling out of business banking.
Specialty financing and things.
Yeah, exactly. And just generally getting back to, well, I don't think they want the risk involved, and obviously the regulator is now on them to hold more capital against these positions, so it's more easier for them to move out of it. So if you look at someone that's going to come in and get involved in that sort of disruptive business, then that's quite a good place to be. So they own a few different types. It's not just sort of your funding circle or your crowdfunding type businesses. They have some invoice discounting businesses. They have, and it goes across the spectrum as well, from sort of small account holders to large institutional type business and things like that. I think they've got quite a large opportunity in the US going forward. The company's transitioning. Originally, it was a fund that just had a CLO portfolio, and they were basically a high dividend paying investment trust. So they're transitioning into
what CLO? Sorry.
A collateralized loan obligation.
So all right, okay.
Bucket of mortgages or loans or things like that. So it was like a high yield finance fund.
Yes.
The new CEO is coming, Jeff Miller. He used to be a fund manager, I believe, at Exeter in the financial circles. And he's turned it into this peer-to-peer lending business. They take stakes in the businesses. They also loan their money through the businesses. And at the moment, well, I should mention, it has a very nice dividend yield. It pays 5p a share of dividend, which equates to about 8.5% at the moment.
I was just going to say that. I've just seen nearly 9% dividend yield is shown on Stockopedia. That's remarkable.
Yeah, well, that came about as a result of the cash that's being thrown off by the CLO portfolio. Now, they've just sold that. They sold that this year to another fund, Fair Oaks Income Fund, which also listed. But they've retained a certain amount. So they're getting some income from that. And his plan, although the dividend is uncovered at the moment, his plan is not to cut the dividend, but the dividend will
eventually... I didn't catch that. They are or they're not going to cut the dividend?
No, they're not going to cut the dividend.
Right.
But his plan is obviously in due course, fairly short order, that income will be covered out of monies earned through lending on the peer-to-peer platforms that they have stakes in.
Okay. So, the peer-to-peer lenders, though, a lot of them generally are loss-making at the moment, aren't they?
They are, but obviously if you lend through the platform...
Ah, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
But obviously their stakes will be valued at whatever their stakes are valued, but they also lend money through the platform as well to generate the return.
Right, okay, so they're generating return from that, yeah.
Exactly, and it's not fantastic. I mean, it's valued sort of just above book at the moment. I think where you might get a revaluation there as well is when you start seeing a few of these peer-to-peer lenders going public. I think there's a couple due to go public in the States.
Are there any names we might recognise for the peer-to-peer lenders that GLIF has invested in?
They own, what do they own? I must admit, I don't know off the top of my head. They own, I think it's Black Knight. But there's about 15 in there. Not some of the, it's not the ones that we would see. In terms of sort of Zopa and RateSetter and things like that, it tends to be a bit more at the higher end of the higher monetary end. So they're not targeting individuals, but it's an interesting. It's one that I like being paid a sensible dividend rather than waiting for something to happen.
I'll take a look at that one. Thanks for that. And it's 82 million market cap. That one AIM listed. It's not something I've looked at before. Are they quite liquid, the shares, or?
Yeah, they're pretty liquid. They generally trade on. Obviously the market maker quote would be about 1p wide.
That's not too bad, is it?
Inside of that. It's a nice business. I'm actually due to have a chat with the CEO later on this week, so hopefully I'll have some more interest there. But we shall see.
Good.
And then the second one on the similar sort of sphere. Actually, I think you have spoken before in your audio talk. I think it was Tungsten Group.
The ticker there is TUNG.
And that's a bit of a different play, very much in the invoice discounting. But I think you were there as well. We met the guy who runs it, Eddie Truell, and he's obviously a serial entrepreneur and highly experienced. And very much it's At the moment, there's no figures as such to speak of in terms of in profits. It is very much buying into his vision of how he looks to take it forward. But I think that that could be huge, certainly if you look at the amount of savings that he's talking about offering companies.
Yeah, I mean, clever bit there. I mean, I think it's my second biggest holding, actually, bizarrely enough. I didn't realise it was, but I've got it scattered around in various different accounts. The clever thing he's done is marrying up an e-invoicing platform with lots and lots of very big clients with offering invoice discounting through that platform, isn't it? So the whole thing is totally seamless and risk-free. And you've got a captive supplier base of large customers who use the e-invoicing platform. And the numbers are staggering. I mean, they're already talking about hundreds of billions of invoices per annum flowing through their existing, what they've already got, haven't they? So if they can, they can monetize a part of that by making a profit from the invoice discounting, the numbers are, it's not fanciful to imagine this being a 10 bagger or more over the next few years.
If it works.
Exactly.
I mean, if you look at how much work it takes out of the cycle for the large company as well, because it's all sort of guaranteed compliant for whatever jurisdiction you're invoicing and things like that. So
yeah, that's
it takes
true.
a lot of legwork out.
Yeah, a lot of governments are mandating the use of e-invoicing, aren't they, so that they can stamp down on VAT evasion, rather.
Yes.
Yes, okay. The price of tungsten has been very, very weak lately, though, hasn't it? It hasn't bounced like a lot of...
No, it's a drift down from that sort of £4 high. I mean, it did do this earlier in the year as well, albeit from a low base. It went down from sort of 3.30. Yeah, I mean, it did only float this year as well, when it got up to sort of 3.30. Had a run down to about £2.10. It's going to be volatile just because there aren't any. It's more of a perception at the moment, and having to take a punt on the management involved. So it is.
Yeah.
It is very. It's not for everyone.
Very high beta stock, isn't it? It really does go all over the place. Although I like the fact that management, I think, bought about £2.7 million of the stock in a recent $10 million or roughly placing.
A bit of money raised at I think it was £350, wasn't it? And I think he owns the CEO owns a fairly hefty amount of the company. £40-50 million. Which is not insignificant, no matter how rich.
No, that's right. Okay, so that's tungsten. So finally, actually, we haven't got that much time left, Craig, but we were going to touch on this whole Equity First Holdings scandal that's been brewing in the last week, which has covered 6 shares. Of course, Quindel, it looks like it could be the thing that actually pulls Quindel down. There was an article in the Sunday Times today, wasn't there, on the front page of the business section, saying that Quindel's been turned down refinancing by its banks and is now talking to hedge funds to try and raise some more cash. I think that's going to be very damaging to them when they open on Monday. Your thoughts on this whole business of director buys that appear to be buys but are actually concealed sales and all the rest of it?
It comes down to sort of AIM governance, doesn't it, really? At best, you could say that if you were to take them at face value and they're putting their shares up as a collateral against a loan, you could say that it could be that they're looking to raise some money for a purchase, like a house purchase, and they're sort of cash poor assets.
Two of them have claimed it was for that, haven't they? The guy at OPay and the guy at CloudBuy.
You could look at it that way.
A house purchase. Yeah.
But I mean, you sort of think, and certainly, I know banks used to lend against a company stock in the sort of pre-financial crisis. They used to take the stock as collateral, but I don't really buy it, because at the end of the day, you've got to pay it back in 3 years' time, so where are you going to get the money from? So if he's going to have a long-term incentive plan, maybe, but I don't really buy it. Obviously, the second one is that they're using it as a short-term fillip to the share price to show it as a buy. And certainly in the case of Quindel, when they initially announced it, it was put out as a buy, and there was no real mention of how it was funded, so it's trying to prop up the share price. And lastly, and I think this is, I think Tom Winifred, who's done a lot of work on this, and
He's been 100% right on it, on this stuff, and I think he deserves enormous praise instead of all the abuse he's been getting from bulletin board people.
Well, exactly. Some people, unfortunately, don't want to listen to it. It's very rare that companies are actually brought down by short sellers doing it maliciously. Short sellers tend to do a lot more research, and if a company goes bust as a result of people being short, it's generally that the company has been doing something wrong. But get back to the equity first. I think the third reason is possibly it could be some sort of tax play. You dress it up to avoid paying CGT. You dress it up as a loan. you then default on that loan, you've got the shares have then had to give up as your collateral, and then maybe you're not. I'm not a tax expert, so I don't know that there could be that angle to it. What I have found striking is that all the companies involved seem to have the same Nomad. So I don't know if it's
kind of which one is that? Name and shame them, Craig.
I think Canaccord are involved in them all, Canaccord. But so don't quote me on that. But I'm fairly certain I read on one of those reports that it was the same Nomad. Which if it is, then maybe that's a way they have of doing some tax.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I've been looking into these equity first holding deals in quite a bit of detail, and in the wording of the RNSs, they say that equity first commit that they won't short sell the stock. Well, of course, they don't need to short sell it because they can just sell it because the director has actually transferred ownership of the shares to equity first, so they don't need to short the stock; they just sell it. And if you look at their there have been some legal cases, which you can find easily on Google, where Equity First has sold the collateral in the first few weeks of setting the loan up, and it's then fallen apart. The other key thing is that these loans are non-recourse. Now,
yeah, I mean, that's it. If they were recourse...
a loan that's non-recourse is a gift, isn't it? Or a sale. Very, very odd.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, and certainly in a couple of the cases, I'd say, I think Quindo is a different story because there's been a lot of murkiness around the business over dragged up by Verity over the last year, and it doesn't create any cash flows. So I think in that instance, it's possibly the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of just sort of forcing the company down. But some of the others, you do wonder sort of what the end game is. If you look at the optimal payments one, the guy sold it. If he is genuinely selling his shares, as we would like to term it now. He sold them at a 27% discount. If he did just want to sell, it's only a small amount, it's only sort of 1.5 million shares. That could quite easily have been done in a placing at a much smaller discount. So,
well, it's a liquid stock. He could have just sold them in the open market and
maybe taken
a 4 or 5% haircut at worst. So I think that one's more a case. Although I don't think they've helped themselves in the clarification statement they put out on Friday.
It
was no good. They were trying to sort of stick to their ground on it and just give a bit more detail. They should have just done a mea culpa, said, look, we got it wrong. The director was an idiot. We apologise. And then it could have moved on. But instead, you know, the share price dropped 20%. I should add, I actually bought some Opay on Friday on the 20% drop because I think this doesn't affect the fundamental value.
I've taken a small long position on that just because it seems to be a pretty solid company. It's generating some good numbers and it's showing some good growth. So I think around this whole matter, there needs to be more disclosure from directors. If they are entering these sort of slightly questionable transactions, then they need to. If you are going to put your loan stock out on loan, you should be made to sort of effectively publicise the whole document in terms of all the pertinent terms so everyone knows where they stand.
Exactly.
And it's almost like having something over one of the directors, and ultimately if you've got a loan to them, you've got a hold over them. If there was anything else compromising, you want to know about it, so why not?
Yeah, I agree. And these equity first holdings deals, the director has transferred ownership of those shares to equity first holdings. So that is a disposal. There's no ifs or buts about it. They're not under any obligation to buy them back. It's an option to buy them back. So the way I look at it, and the loan, supposed loan, is non-recourse. So, of course, you put all that together, and it's clearly a disposal with an option to buy them back if they feel like it. That's the nature of these deals, isn't it?
It's almost like an equities pawnbroker, I think.
Yes.
That sort of thing. But you never come back for your goods. Well, you may do. You never know. It's 3 years down the line. We'll have to see if the companies are around in 3 years' time. Do the directors come back and take the shares back?
So. Well, exactly. Well, I think Equity First Holdings' modus operandi, being cynical, is that they know full well that most of the companies tendering these stocks are junk or close to junk, and that 9 out of 10 cases, the directors are probably not going to want the stock back. So they can sell it for maybe 20-25% more than the amount of, if they sell immediately, more than the amount of money they have to advance, and they pocket the cash. And actually, there's a case which I found, a legal action where that is specifically set out here. Section D is from the Delaware Superior Court, a case or against Equity First Holdings, where it says the seller of the pledged stock within weeks of the closing of the February loan. During February and March of 2006, Equity First Holdings sold approximately 98% of the TMM stock pledged by Mrs. Segovia on the open market, and blah, 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 blah. But it's, you know, there's documentary evidence out there that this is what they do. So it's not supposition. It's that they've actually done it in the past and been sued by people for it.
Yeah. Well, it's a very questionable company to be having dealings with. I'm sure there's more ethical companies out there.
They're not even regulated.
No, exactly. Yeah. If you take the first scenario, someone is just looking to raise money for a specific purchase. There's better places you can do. I'm not naive enough to think that that is likely to be the case in some of these. But so the amounts involved are quite small in terms of number of shares of the company. So I think it's very different between a situation like Quindel, where you've got a number of things going on, and some of the other companies where there's one or two things going on. It's not right in any occasion.
Well, I think there's no, I agree.
Breakers for some of the others, and it could be ones that it does present an opportunity in there, albeit.
I agree.
Sort of mea culpa from the CEOs involved and possibly looking to replace that CEO involved in certain cases.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think some of these directors may well have to fall on their swords. I mean, the other thing that was interesting with the Quindel one, where Rob Terry pledged his entire stake. It was up to however many millions. And everyone thought, well, hang on, what's going on? He's only bought £1 million of the stock, and he's pledged whatever it was at the time, 50-odd million pounds of the stock as security.
Yeah.
And I think that showed a very clear intention to sell a whole lot. Also, to date, Rob Terry has received £7.5 million from the pledged stock to ETF, but he's only bought 1.5 million, so 1/5 of Quindel's stock in the open market. Also, if you look at the dates and the amounts, it's rapidly dwindling. So on the 5th of November, before it all blew up, he bought £1.2 million of stock. Then when it was all blowing up, the next purchase 5 days later was only £250,000, and then the next day, only £50,000.
Well, yeah, there haven't been any
since on the days when the stock, when QPP stock was collapsing. So I think it's very obvious what his intentions are. He's got no intention at all of spending the loan proceeds on buying stock.
Well, no, exactly. And there might not be any stock to buy if you believe that they're going cap in hand to hedge funds to refinance the business anyway. Certainly Quindel is one that I've been very interested in. I didn't have a position actually until I saw. So it was your chat at Derby that I saw, and I still saw it was valued at $550 million despite all the announcements that have come out. And I did have a little bit of short term trading action on it this week, only from the short term. Yes. I wasn't as brave as yourself, but I was quite happy to be short for a while. No position at the moment.
Yes, I mean, I went short. Well, I've been short for a while, but last week when it really plummeted, I closed short and went long for intraday, and then went short again. So I think it's just a trading stock at the moment. Nobody really knows what it's
going to be. No, but there's too many uncertainties in there. The thing is, if you get these sort of opportunities, you know, sometimes if you're sensible about it, you can make some good extra money by trading around it. But obviously that involves sitting in front of your desk all day. So
that's the trouble, isn't it? Yes. No, you'd rather be on the golf course, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
And I don't blame you. Well, we better sign off, Craig. So we've done a pretty comprehensive chat. Thanks ever so much for your time. Any
Very
final
welcome.
Points you want to make, or should we?
No. I think that's covered everything. Hopefully, it hasn't been too amateurish compared to some of your other interviewees.
Absolutely excellent, Craig. So thank you very much indeed.
Excellent. Thank you.
We'll have you back in a few weeks' time, I think.
Lovely.
Cheers, Craig.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.